Hello, and welcome to AcePod 1.7, brought to you by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship. I am your host, Ace Sandbender, once again flying solo today. Going to get to a mailbag real quick that has had some time to cool post-Army. But first, I wanted to get into a little bit of cleaning up from the weekend in college football during Michigan's bye week. You may have had the distinct displeasure of watching much of the afternoon slate, which was, it seemed like El Asico kind of infected the entire weekend, especially the Big Ten. And somebody who caught a real bad case of the Big Tens was Pat Narduzzi, which makes a little bit of sense since he is one of ours. And he is still defending his decision to kick a field goal from the 1 yard line while down 7 with 5 minutes left in the fourth quarter against Penn State in a game that they would lose by 7. This is from, I'm just going to read this quote in all its glory because it is an amazing look into the mind of a certain type of coach. This is from Andrea Adelson at ESPN, relayed this on Twitter. This is Pat Narduzzi. But again, the thinking and the logic, guys, is I have no regrets with the call at all. I really don't. And I look back and we had 2 plays in that series. My regret is we didn't score in one of those 3 plays. That's the regret. And my regret is we didn't execute them properly. And our kids know, our coaches know. I mean, we can't have a film session here, but in your pocket you've got a game plan here, and you've got so many calls that you go, it's going to work. And we had 2 that we really thought were going to work. And if I dissected them with you, you'd go, okay, I'd see what you're talking about. We didn't have a 3rd one that we said was going to work like those other 2. And if you didn't execute those properly, which came down to execution, doesn't come down to, I thought we had plays and we just didn't do it right. And so it comes down to that. And we had faith in our defense. So when you look at really what we did, you kick a field goal there, which again, on the other negative, we didn't make a 19-yard field goal, which is a problem. But when you look at it, we did what we wanted to do. We wanted to get 3 there. We wanted to go out and play defense again. I mean, there's a little bit more, but I mean, we can start with the idea that it exonerates the coaching staff that Pitt apparently had precisely 2 plays that they thought could work on the opponent's 1 yard line, and they didn't work. And then there's the idea that down 7 with 5 minutes left in a game where your offense has generated exactly 1 touchdown and you need a touchdown to tie the game, Pat Narduzzi somehow thinks a field goal is useful. When does he think he's going to get down there again? I love how he started this off by saying the thinking and the logic, guys. And he has no regrets, but he did also say that at the end that I apologize to Panther Nation because we all wanted to win that game. And there's nobody that feels worse about that than the guys in this room. And boy, when he talks about that and also execution, I'll put it this way. As a Pitt player, I would not feel like I was put in the best position to succeed, and I wouldn't necessarily love the way it was being talked about. So let's all hope that Pat Narduzzi steps in and replaces Mark D'Antonio whenever he leaves Michigan State, because Cover 4 isn't really the killer it used to be, and man, with thinking like that, you can really go to some dark places. All right, with that out of the way, let's go to the mailbag. Ace, love the pod. Heck, it's why I sponsor it. Thank you, Jason. After Army, I have to ask, what's the most unpleasant victory you can remember? Me? Purdue 1995. 5-0 in the sleet. I do have, my answer is not also Purdue 1995, but I do have memories of that. I was at my parents' house, and I believe, so when we were growing up, we had 2 season tickets, and my dad would switch off taking me and my brother to home games. And I can't remember whose turn it was to go that week, but it did not matter because my dad saw the weather report and absolutely refused, which probably the smart play there. I certainly don't harbor any bitterness. But my dad's old college roommate had flown up with his family from Florida to go to the game, and they were hanging out at our place. We live within walking distance of the stadium, so they were kind of tailgating with us before heading over. And we're kind of trying to maybe sort of talk them out of it based on how things are going. But, you know, they flew up there for the game. They're going to go. We get to halftime, and all of a sudden we hear scuffle on the porch, and the entire family just falls in the door looking like they just tried to summit Everest. And for the rest of the game, they each found heating vents to sit on to thaw out while the rest of us actually watched this hideous game. But anyway, my answer for most unpleasant victory is one I had to cover, and that was 2013. Michigan, who was at that time ranked 11th in the country, based off of I don't know what, this was Brady Hoke's third year, defeats Akron 28-24. This game requires a late Fitz Toussaint touchdown with under three minutes left to go ahead. And then Michigan actually lets Akron drive all the way down to the 2-yard line before finally getting a stop as time expired after three straight snaps inside the 5. So that was a harrowing victory, summed up beautifully by Devin Gardner, who said, "We almost lost to Akron. No disrespect to Akron." Well put. Gardner in that game had 3 picks and a lost fumble. It was a hideous all-around game. The game the very next week is also very much in this discussion. That was when Michigan was saved by a one-handed stab it out of midair Desmond Morgan interception to beat UConn on the road. That actually Michigan went from ranked 11th when they going into the Akron game to 15th when going into the UConn game. And despite winning that road game against UConn, Michigan was unranked when they played Minnesota the following week. So, or 2 weeks later. That tells you how ugly that stretch was, that Michigan managed to fall out of the ranks of the fall out of the polls after after 2 straight victories. What got them on top, I shouldn't have forgotten, was a ludicrous victory over Notre Dame, because that's just how it went in those days. All right, next question. My buddies and I had a long conversation about the Harbaugh tenure and how we have the 9th best winning percentage, 6th if you take out Wisconsin, who plays in a weak division, and Appalachian State, Boise State, of all college football teams since 2015, just behind Clemson, Alabama, Ohio State, Oklahoma, and Georgia. That seems really good. We should be happy. However, we feel that Michigan in particular has not won a big-time game in a while and lost twice in heartbreaking fashion to rivals, which is the main cause of our negative attitude. Do you agree with this sentiment, and what do you think will change fans' perception? Best, Alex. Alex, it's a simple one, and it's one that was answered succinctly by Brad Muckenthaler over at Mason Blue Nation last week, who titled a post, "It's because of Ohio State." And yeah, that's all it is. If the JT Barrett call goes the other way, I think, weirdly enough, we feel different after Army. I mean, there has been so much mounting frustration, especially since Michigan's only Ohio State victory since HD Television was against an interim coach as with Brady Hoke as the head coach. It's been tough. And, you know, after the Rich Rod and Hoke years, every minor setback feels like the prelude to a significant one. But as Brad points out in his post, Bo Schembechler's winning percentage at Michigan over 21 seasons was .796. Gary Moeller was at .758, and Lloyd Carr was at .753. Jim Harbaugh's at .741, and he had to take over from Brady Hoke. Only Bo really had a mess to take over of the Schembechler coaching tree coaches, other than Harbaugh, if you want to include him in there. And Bo had 21 seasons to get his winning percentage up. Otherwise, Harbaugh is pretty much right in line with Mueller and Carr, with the exception of beating Ohio State. And Harbaugh came in with a Brady Hoke roster and coaching to sort out, and had Urban Meyer in place across the way. So I think I've said multiple times in multiple forums, I'm not nearly as down on this team as most people are after the first two games. The bye week hasn't changed that. And Michigan fans are very negative because it's been a long time since the thing that they most want to have happen has happened. And what's going to change that is beating Ohio State. And we'll see. This year, that looks much more difficult than it did even heading into the season. But I still hold out some hope that this I still hold out quite a bit of hope that this team can turn it around. All right, last email question before I get to the tweets. Stipulating first that we all agree there are bigger issues for the offense to resolve for Wisconsin. Do you think a two-quarterback set is a potentially useful extension of a spread on teams with some quarterback depth? Seems like an offense that could cause some repeated conflicts for a defense if a first QB has a read, potentially giving a lateral swing or a handoff to a second quarterback who also has a read with a pass in it. Big fan of yours and have a blog for years. Thank you. Glad to see you back posting and podcasting. Thank you again. Adam, Columbia, South Carolina. I do not see very much potential in the two-quarterback set. And for no other reason than that, I have never seen it work. This is something that usually when you get kind of these bizarre innovations in football, like the crazy A11 formation that they eventually banned, and a whole lot of the innovations we've seen in the spread stuff, a lot of that gets worked out at the high school level. And obviously, it's tough to have two good quarterbacks on a high school team, but you can have two guys on a high school team that can threaten to throw. And I haven't seen at the high school level, I haven't seen anything that I'm aware of at the lower levels of college, another kind of petri dish for strategic innovation. And in the end, you're really not giving yourself, if we're talking specifically about Michigan here, with Dylan McCaffrey as a second quarterback, we've mentioned several times that while he's a good straight line athlete, he is not the all-around agile guy that you'd have if you were playing just a regular receiver in his spot, or a running back, depending on how you want to configure this two-quarterback set. I think Penn State might have tried a couple two-quarterback looks when they had Tommy Stevens backing up Trace McSorley, but it was mostly actually using him as a receiver a little bit, and or just handing it off to him. And I'd much rather see Michigan just throw it to Donovan Peoples-Jones or hand it off to Zach Charbonnet. So I'm not sure if there's as much strategic upside as people would like to think, just because you're sacrificing athleticism, your limitings of what you can do, because Dylan McCaffrey's not a downfield receiving threat. So I think we can all go with our first instinct and just say that can go in the trash bin, because it was rough to watch. All right, we're going to take a quick break and then come back with several of your Twitter questions.
When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters and venues across the state and country, from various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. Or email Jason at blankenshiplawyer.com.
All right, it's time to move on to the Twitter portion of this Q&A. This one is from at Mark Wood Am. Two games in, is there a plausible scenario in which you see our offense being strong this season? I mostly just wanted to include this to show kind of where we're at after two games, because there are many plausible scenarios in which I see the offense being strong this season. If Shea Patterson figures out his reads, the offense is going to be a lot stronger on the ground. When John Runyon comes back, they will be better blocking up front, certainly, than they were in the Army game when Ryan Hayes did not grade out well in Bryant's UFR, and Michigan had some trouble getting some movement on that left side. If, as Josh Gattis figures things out as a play caller, and I sure hope starts pushing the ball downfield more, I see the offense being stronger. Really, the question for me is there a plausible scenario in which I see the offense being this bad all year? And I don't. There is a decent to good line up front. They're installing some stuff that has a lot more upside than the last offense. They're working with a quarterback who should be able to figure things out better than he's shown the first couple games. I am not going to excuse everything that Shea Patterson has done, but I don't think this is the baseline level of play for him either. And got a potential star in the making in Charbonnet. Donovan Peoples-Jones hasn't even seen the field yet. Neither has John Runyon Jr. There's a lot of room for obvious improvement here. And as I've said many times, not nearly as pessimistic about the rest of the season and the offense as seemingly the vast majority of the fan base. There's a lot of reasons for hope. Next question is from at Deadman U of M. This is not a commentary on the team. What are the things that have surprised you in a good way and in a bad way about this team? His answers were good surprise, first string secondary looks strong, although Army didn't give us the best test there. And bad surprise is the run game seems to have regressed despite moving to a spread coordinator and a strong returning O-line. I'll get the bad surprise out of the way, which is that I expected to see, even with Donovan Peoples-Jones out and Michigan playing some iffy opponents, I expected to see them pushing the ball downfield more than they have. It kind of feels like they did that in the first half of the Middle Tennessee State game and then just kind of put it away. And the one time they did really push the ball downfield against Army, it worked. They got a deep pass, touchdown, and then just – Or they got the deep pass interference call against Collins on just a total arm punt and never really went back to it. So just kept slamming into the line. And that has surprised me in a bad way. What has surprised me in a good way is that Zach Charbonnet has not only been a really impressive runner, but he has shown that he can be an every down back and a plus in the passing game, especially in terms of his blitz pickups. He has been perfect so far this season, and especially with True Wilson out injured, that has become clearly quite important since Hassan Haskins and Christian Turner have both had their troubles so far this season picking up blitzes. Both have had at least one pretty major whiff. So that would be my pleasant surprise so far, is that the five-star running back is actually even more well-rounded than expected. I think we can be pretty excited about that. Next one is from at TJ Basala. That Fox broadcast was bad. BTN was meh. What's the best broadcast option there today for Michigan games this season, knowing McDonough and Spielman is the option we want and can't have? Yeah, pour one out for the McDonough-Spielman pairing again. It has been pretty rough this year. I do like Gus on the Fox big noon Saturday broadcasts. Gus, maybe enunciate that a bit better next week. But Joel Klatt is pretty take it or leave it for me. Sometimes he's very insightful. Sometimes I kind of wonder what he's looking at. I still think Gus brings enough that's a preferable group to what you're going to get on the ESPN ABC slate at noon, and certainly better than what you're going to get with the Big Ten group. My holdout hope here is that Michigan gets a night game where they draw Sean McDonough, Todd Blackledge, and Holly Rowe, which I think is a really strong group that is on ESPN's college football primetime. That would be really the only, I think the Notre Dame game would be the only real shot there based on how the schedule has shaken out so far. Feller and Herb Street is a decent, and with Maria Taylor or Tom Rinaldi on the sideline for the ABC night games is also, I mean, solid. I know Michigan fans don't necessarily love Herb Street, but, you know. Otherwise, I'll be honest, it's bleak. I mean, if you get bumped to FS1, as I'm assuming Michigan is going to a couple times this year, that's when you get the dreaded Tim Brando-Spencer Tillman pairing. Brando's already blocked me on Twitter for my commentary about his commentary, so I think my thoughts there are have been made well enough, but it's not a great scene out there if you're a Big Ten fan and you're hoping to draw great announcers. Yeah, it's disappointing. Hopefully some things shift around over time, and really the biggest issue for me is Fox having Brando and Tillman as their number two college football pair after Gus Johnson and Joel Klatt, because those guys for me are just brutal. Hopefully at some point those guys either get shifted around or decide to move on. All right, this next one is from Ben Tozer, who is a football player from Michigan who hasn't really had their moment yet, but who you think still might break out this season. I know this isn't necessarily where the question was going, but I'm going to kind of double down on what I said earlier and say Shea Patterson. I know it hasn't been good. I know some of the issues that he's shown in terms of reads were things that popped up last year. But I also just think, especially once they get DPJ back into the mix, and I do believe that they're going to open things up downfield at some point, that he's going to show off that deep ball. He's going to get more confident. I thought in the first half of the Middle Tennessee game, he came out in rhythm and confident and firing, and he was really productive. And then, you know, the second half, they started kind of muddying things up with those two quarterback sets and whatever. And then the Army game was just a tire fire from the beginning. But we've seen Shea Patterson play much better than he has so far this season. This is his final year. He's going to be playing for his NFL future, and he's still melding with his receiving group, which never seems to be healthy all at once, and his offensive coordinator, with a pretty dramatic style change from last year. I just think it's so early to make that judge. To make that judgment after two games. I think Shea Patterson, you know, he might not be a Heisman candidate. I think we can definitively say probably not at this point, but, you know, still in competition for all Big Ten behind Justin Fields. Absolutely. It's wide open there. And Patterson has all the potential. We know he can do it, and it's just a matter of putting things together and kind of downloading the offense a bit more than he has so far. And that can happen over the course of a season. This was a well-timed bye week, I would say, for making progress on that front. Two more. These are personal. So if you're done with the sports stuff, I won't be offended if you stop listening. First one, I actually didn't think I had something, and then I remembered I had something from @BrendanGoBlue. Can you share a good dog story on the podcast this week? So if you follow me on Twitter, you've probably seen me post pictures of my brother's dog, Ivy. Some people think it's my dog. It's not. It's my brother's. We just spend a lot of time around each other. I spent a fair amount of time dog sitting for Ivy, too. And a couple weeks ago, I had Ivy on the couch, and she was sort of part falling asleep, part just kind of in that, like, you know, dog's kind of out of its own. And I was being the obnoxious dog uncle trying to get some decent pictures of her on the couch, and she wouldn't quite, you know, she has, like, the best pictures of her are when she's looking at you wide enough where you can get the whites of her eyes. Otherwise, her eyes are pretty dark, and they kind of, her fur is black and white, mostly black, so otherwise her eyes kind of just blend in with her fur, unless your camera's really good. So I was trying to get a decent picture, and she was a little sleepy-eyed, and was saying her name, trying to get her attention, and that wasn't working, and then kind of crouched down, and didn't mean to, but started to let out a long, slow fart. And that got me an absolutely stellar picture from Ivy, because not only did her eyes open, but her ears perked up a little bit, and it was adorable. So I guess a pro tip, if you got a dog out there and you're trying to get the right picture, maybe let one loose. See what happens. Then last question. Oh goodness, I'm not even going to attempt this this terrible Twitter handle. I'll try. AJ Rusk 5K, also known as Hatin' Ass Aaron, asked me, how have you been feeling lately with the increased workload? I haven't really talked about this much because sort of hit the ground running with football season starting back up pretty much as soon as I came back. And just also trying to get a feel for what's going on, get my legs under me, so to speak. Say the past 2 years have been the most difficult for me in terms of my health. Obviously, I had to take time off after I had my gallbladder surgery. And then that was last May, and never really bounced back from that. And the summer had some difficult times. Weight's kind of fluctuated a lot, but at the moment I'm doing quite well. It is still a day-to-day, week-to-week thing in terms of knowing how much energy I'm going to have on any given day, knowing how much I'm going to be able to produce on a given day. You know, kind of thought this podcast was going to happen last week, and then I was a little tired after the beginning of the week, and it's happening now. So right now I'm really focused on making sure that I'm up for the major things that I've got to be up for, getting my sleep as right as I can for game day, getting up for the podcast the next day. You know, weekends are pretty big for me right now, and then I've very much taken Mondays to just decompress the last few weeks. My weight is as high as it's ever been, which is usually a very encouraging sign for me. The Klonopin withdrawal effects that I was experiencing over the summer have mostly subsided. That's something that kind of takes months to fully get past, but the worst of it, the part that was keeping me awake at night, is over. And it's been very good from a mental standpoint to get back into work, get back into some level of a routine, and also have that, help me interact with more people, because believe it or not, taking time off at where you spend most of your time at home alone can be a bit isolating, especially when you live by yourself. Just having kind of the madness of college football to distract me a few days a week also gives me a reason to get together with people I want to watch games. It's been a big step forward, particularly from where I was last year, and even as recently as this summer. There's been really good progress. I'm working on not getting out ahead of myself with that, because there's been times in the past where I've thought I've been on the verge of a breakthrough and maybe even remission. And obviously that has not happened yet. So I'm cautiously optimistic about where things are at right now. And I think I will close on cautiously optimistic. That's been a running theme. So thank you very much for listening to the Ace Pod. Don't forget to rate and review all of the MGO blog podcast offerings on the MGO podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Those are always greatly appreciated, especially if they are 5 stars. Hopefully I'll be back with more next week. Thanks for listening. And if you would like to add your sponsorship to this podcast, don't hesitate to reach out to Seth Fisher. Thanks again.